You shouldn't encourage me.
So thanks very much. I'm going to the Winged Ox now, so I hope you enjoyed the talk. At 7 o'clock, supposedly, I'm there to do cafe science. I'm good, but I'm not that good. I'm going to try astral projection. Or I could send Ian Archer. Is he an archer here? Because we keep getting confused. 2 weeks ago, his face came up on my Facebook. I was tagged as him. So I don't know if Ian's here. You can do the Winged Ox. Right, where are we? Oh, I haven't started yet. That's right. Yeah. One other thing. It says one-time Christian in the brochure. One-time Christian evangelist and charismatic. And it says Pete now does icon. What's that about? That's terrible. What are they trying to say about me? One-time Christian. Now, admittedly, I did write it. But what I meant by it, or I did, there was another line which they obviously took out, which said that Peter is becoming Christian. Yeah, and there was another one about being Christ follower or something. So they just took that out, and it sounds really dodgy, like I've just thrown it all away. So no, I'm kind of becoming Christian or something like that. I see Rob Bell's here, by the way. You know why he's here? No original material. He's here. Honestly, nothing. Nothing to say. He's there frantically finding notes, writing notes. Velvet Elvis. You want the truth? I wrote that. No. He was in the initial meeting. You know what he said? He says, Pete, puts his hand up. Pete. I'm going, Rob, you know, because his ideas are rubbish. Like, I was thinking Cliff Richard in denim. Going, oh, no, Rob. Keep your fantasies to yourself. I'm not going to buy that. Do stick with Velvet Elvis. So I hope you get a few notes wherever you are. I know you're there somewhere. Got all of that cleared up. Got something else. I made a tract. Have you seen this? Hey, you like it? And they're all around you. As a gift for coming to hear me speak, because you need something, you'll kind of get one as you're going out the door. Having said that, we don't have enough left, only a few of you'll get one. But it's called The Rapture, and it's kind of inspired by Jack T. Chick. And I'm going to just read the parable. I read it last night, but this talk's going to be a type of commentary on the parable. So it simply goes like this. Just as it was written by those prophets of old, the last days of the earth overflowed with suffering and with pain. In those dark days, a huge pale horse rode through the earth with death upon its back and hell in its wake. During this great tribulation, the earth was scorched with the fires of war. Rivers ran red with blood. The soil withheld its fruit, and disease descended like a mist. One by one, all the nations of the earth were brought to their knees. Far from all the suffering, high up in the heavenly realm, God watched the events unfold with a heavy heart. An ominous silence had descended upon heaven as the angels witnessed the earth being plunged into darkness and despair. But this could only continue for so long, for at a designated time, God stood upright, breathed deeply, and addressed the angels with a booming voice. The time has come for me to separate the sheep from the goats, the healthy wheat from the inedible chaff. Having spoken these words, God slowly turned to face the world and called forth to the church with a booming voice. Anyway, it's the faceless God, Jack T. Chick's signature God. Rise up and ascend to heaven, all you who have sought to escape the horrors of this world by sheltering beneath my wing. Come to me, all who have turned from this suffering world by calling out, Lord, Lord. In an instant, millions were caught up in the clouds and ascended into the heavenly realm, leaving the suffering world behind them. Once this great rapture had taken place, God paused for a moment and then addressed the angels, saying, It is done. I have separated the people born of my spirit from those who have turned from me. It is time now for us to leave this place and take up residence in the earth. For it is there that we shall find our people. The ones who would forsake heaven in order to embrace the earth. The few who would turn away from eternity itself to serve at the feet of a fragile, broken life that passes from existence in but an instant. And so it was that God and the heavenly host left that place to dwell among those who had rooted themselves upon the earth, quietly supporting the ones who had forsaken God for the world, and thus who bore the very mark of God, the few who had discovered heaven in the very act of forsaking it. And then you've got a little thing you can do just if you want to give up salvation. You can follow the rules at the back and say the prayer and all of that. So what's it about? I don't know. I just get very drunk and then just start writing. And then people publish these things crazy. No, there is a point. There's an old psychoanalytic joke. And it goes, it's not very funny, don't laugh. It says, you know, how many psychoanalysts does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb has to really, really want to change. That's kind of the idea, is if you're going into therapy, you've got to really, really want to change. Why else would you be there? Why would you be going to therapy if you didn't really want to change? But the truth is that we don't want to change. People who are in therapy don't really want to change in a fundamental way. Most of us are terrified about scratching beneath the surface, of finding what insidious things lie beneath. And as soon as it starts getting deep, as soon as somebody starts saying something that gets to the heart, we start backing off. We get tense, we get scared. A lot of people go to different types of therapy, which are more about, you know, finding techniques that will help you do your job better, that will allow you to have sex, that will allow you to have a relationship. And the idea is, don't delve into the whole family thing. Just fix me. Just get me working again. And so while we think we want to change, we don't really. And it's the same in church. We may say we want to change. We may go to this place because we want to hear about how we should be kinder to those who are outside the walls of the community, that we should be giving more, that we should be more generous with our time and with our money. And yet, in a way, we don't do it. And we start to engage in the process of irony. I talked about this last year, so I won't go into it in too much detail. But irony being the act of doing something that you disavow. And the example I used last year, I think, was a 70s disco, where you wear the 70s clothes and you dance to the 70s music while slagging off the 70s clothes and slagging off the 70s music. So what you're doing is you're doing the activity while attacking the activity. So you're driving a big SUV while talking about the environment, or you're talking about the evils of global capitalism while having a coffee in Starbucks, the ironic gesture. And of course, at a superficial level, we're changing all the time. You might change, for example, your fashion. One year you'll wear, I don't know, whatever. Well, next year, you know, you change it to whatever. The point being, you know, while you change your fashion at a deeper level, you're not changing in the sense that fashion is still important to you. So the change belies the fact that at a deep level, you're not really changing. Now, why is somebody in therapy then? Well, they might be there because not that they desire to change, but that they see they're hurting somebody else. And so it's their partner who said, you know, you should really try and get help, you know, or their family member or something like that. So they're not there because they want to change. They're there because they see that their actions are hurting somebody else. And that's why they're going through the painful process. So there are reasons why people are in therapy, but often it's not because they really want to change in a substantial way. Now, the reason why I want to start with that idea is because Christianity, for me, fundamentally is about transforming us at a deep level. Rebirth. you must be born again. I love that idea. You know, in Northern Ireland, we wear that on sandwich boards and all that. I think it's brilliant. I'm a real fundamentalist at heart, you know, and because I think there's something vital that the people who wear these signs understand, that Christianity is about reconfiguring our entire existence. But that's an incredibly painful thing. It's something that most of us don't want to do. We don't want to be a new creation. We prefer the old. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. I won't do that. Yeah. So what I want to do is I want to kind of look at how Christianity implements fundamental change, and it'll kind of connect in with the title of the talk, hopefully, at some stage. Now, I'm unapologetically Pauline, okay? And by that, I mean that Paul is the first person to write about Christianity. So he's the earliest writer, but well before the Gospels, Paul is the first one to sit down and start writing about Jesus. And of course, what's interesting about it, most of us know, he doesn't really have any interest in Jesus at all. As the earliest writer, he doesn't talk about what Jesus says, doesn't tell us about the parables, doesn't tell us about his life and the miracles. He pretty much is about Christ crucified. And I think he's onto something, you know. he'll be happy to hear that, you know. Because, like, Jesus would be turning in his grave if he heard some of the things I say. Delete that joke from the talk, would you? So Christ crucified. Now, it's interesting because the point is, most of what Jesus said wasn't unique. Most of what Jesus did wasn't unique. All of the sayings can be traced to other sayings that were before Jesus, that were being said by people around the same time as Jesus, and that have been said after Jesus. For example, the golden rule. It's there before Jesus. The miracles, so many of the miracles that Jesus did have been attributed to other gods and other kind of characters. There's not that much unique there. What is unique about Christ? Well, incarnation, death, resurrection. These are the properly theological notions. These are the Christology. And I want to kind of delve into that. Not that what Jesus said isn't important, but I want to go, what is happening when a Christian says, I participate in the death of Christ? What happens when we break bread together and remember Christ? That theological act that Paul was so interested in. When Jesus died on the cross, he was stripped of everything. Everything. When you were put on a cross, you were taken out of society. You were a criminal. You weren't a citizen. You were nothing. You were refuge. You were put on a cross. You were stripped of your identity, your political identity, your social identity, your religious identity. It was all taken away from you. So there is a sense in which Christ is stripped of everything on the cross. But at a more fundamental level, Christ is also stripped of God. See, all religions have a place for doubt. All religions have a place for a sense of divine abandonment, for the dark night of the soul, for the cloud of unknowing. Christianity is unique in that this doubt is not something that is between God and humanity. This doubt is relocated into the very heart of God. It's not that we experience the abandonment of God. On the cross, we read of how God experiences the abandonment of God, where God becomes an atheist. This radical self-emptying, where everything is stripped away, where Christ says, my God, why have you forsaken me? So, when you doubt in Christianity, you're actually participating in the very divine economy. When you experience the Nietzschean death of God, that existential, utter abandonment of God, you're actually participating in the God moment, in something central to Christianity. Now, as an aside, this is part of the problem with the new atheism. You have traditional, I'll call it religious Christianity. I'm going to define religion later, maybe. So religious Christianity, and it affirms God. It says God exists, God's there. And then you have the negation, right, of that, which you could say is like Dawkins or Harris. They say, no, God doesn't exist. Walk away. You know, Christianity's useless. God's not there. It's all make-believe. In Christianity, the idea of, no, God's not there, no, the divine abandonment, we're left alone, the radical contingency of existence, is the very sight of God. It's not against Christianity to experience that radical stripping away of a sacred canopy, of something that grounds us, of something that anchors us. It's not you either affirm God and you're a Christian, or you negate God and you experience doubt and uncertainty and atheism, and so you walk away from Christianity. The negation of negation is the bringing together of these. In the very moment that you feel a radical contraction, God is not there, you are alone. No one cares about you. You will die. You will rot. And everybody you know will rot. Everyone who loves you will be gone. When you experience the horror, and it's not actually, it is a horror. I was going to say the tragedy, but it's not a tragedy, because a tragedy is heroic. It's a comedy. A comedy has no value, no meaning in the traditional sense. It's comic, the comic nature of existence. This is a very moment when you experience Christ's cry of dereliction on the cross, where you experience the divine moment, where you participate in that. So when you break bread and you drink wine and you participate in that broken body, that's the craziest sacrament to take part in. Because what you're doing is you are taking part in the divine dereliction. You're identifying with Christ, who becomes nothing, what in theology is called kenosis, where you're stripped of everything, you know, where God becomes nothing, even losing God. There's loads in that. This is why Ernst Bloch, for example, says only an atheist can be a good Christian, and only a good Christian can be an atheist. This is why Slavoj Žižek, who is a theologian who doesn't believe in God, you know, but he keeps coming back to theology and Christianity because he says, my feeling of God's abandonment, every time I experience that, just like Mother Teresa, whenever she experienced this, her spiritual advisor said, in this moment of desolation, you are more identifying with Christ than at any other time. I don't know if that makes any sense, but we're going to get there. So conversion, the moment of identifying with the death of Christ, could it possibly mean not, because we think of conversion as you get a new way of looking at the world. You get a new worldview. You get a new paradigm. And there's lots of these books, you know, Worldview Christianity. And Christianity is compared to other worldviews like Marxism, you know, capitalism, humanism, behaviorism. You know, as if when you become a Christian, you're given a new sense of meaning. But perhaps the fundamental moment of conversion is not where you're given meaning. It's where all meaning is stripped away from you. Where you experience that everything that had meaning before, everything that was your God before, everything that defined who you are, suddenly lacks power, is ripped away. Now, I'm going to use the example of my conversion. My conversion was a bit crazy. I was 17 years old, and I kind of had a radical conversion, kind of almost like a street conversion. And one day I didn't believe, and the next day I went to this charismatic church, and I went to the front of church. I'd have to fill in a few gaps as to how I got to church. But within a week, I'd never really been at church. But within a week, I was going to this charismatic church, and within about 3 or 4 weeks, I walked up to the front, did the conversion, felt like completely reborn. And what I did is I went home to my parents, I sat them down and I said, I am no longer your son. I am no longer part of this family. You know, I'm not your son anymore. And then what I did is I took all of my stuff and I put it all out in the hallway. And I called some friends to ask them to take it away, to kind of take my TV and all of this kind of stuff. And I was doing an IT course in tech. I had one GCSE, and then went to tech for 3 more years and got 3 more GCSEs. Pretty good. And then I started doing a course in IT. And I just basically stopped going to the course in IT. And I became a raving fundamentalist in many ways. However, the point is, while all of that sounds crazy, what was going on? No, really, what was going on? No, I don't. Yeah, here's what I think. In some primordial way, everything that defined who I was suddenly lacked power. Just immediately, everything. So my family represents, you know, they're really nice, you know, my parents are great, and we're all, of course, it's all fine now, you know, but they represented, you know, a polite, apolitical, middle-class kind of worldview, Northern Ireland worldview. They suddenly didn't have power anymore. My possessions, I was very anal about stuff, you know. I had, like, and all my stuff was perfectly positioned, and everything was aspirational. You know, I even had a, you know, had a Wendy James poster on my wall, if you remember Wendy James, Transvision Vamp. Trust me, yeah, yeah. And I had like a car, like a red sports car on the wall. It's terrible, you know. A Ferrari Testarossa. Yeah, I was a big fan of Miami Vice. And, you know, all of this defined my values. These defined who I was. I mean, if you knew me then and you knew me now, I'm completely different. Like, you know, I'm crazy now. So all of this stuff defined my value system. And suddenly it meant nothing. I just got rid of it all, and so I had just had a mattress in my room. And the tech represented, you know, what I wanted to do, get a career, settle down, maybe work my way up to middle management by my 30s, whatever it was I wanted to do. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's what I wanted. That was the value system that held me. And suddenly it just didn't mean anything. So while I maybe expressed it in a very unhealthy way, there was something about experiencing the divine kenosis in that experience. These things that once held power no longer held any power. These were my gods. These were the things that I could not see. They defined how I saw everything. You know, they were the things that, it's like water, you know, and all of that, the fish, yeah, you all know that, yeah. Fish doesn't see the water it's swimming in. But that was the thing. These were the values that defined who I was. How am I doing for time? Oh my goodness. I'm doing much slower at the moment. That's crazy. Is this what Paul means when he says there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female? And of course we can go further and say neither Protestant nor Catholic, neither theist nor atheist, neither Christian nor non-Christian, for all are made one in Christ. What does that mean? Well, to be identified in Christ is to identify with one who is completely devoid of identity. And in that moment of being found in the identity of Christ, all of the things that define, so in Paul's time, Jew and Greek, slave and free, male and female, right, these are all the things that defined your substance, who you were, what position you had in society. All of these suddenly don't have their operative power anymore. They're all drained of it. And you experience yourself as a subject beyond your substance, as a subject beyond your positioning in society, beyond the capitalist mechanism. You feel a moment of freedom, that anything is possible, a radical contingency. And that's a very powerful experience. Now, this is, I suppose my example is the Prisoner, you know, The Prisoner? The 60s series, I think it was 60s, which is amazing. The Americans are making a remake, and you know they're going to screw it up. You know, I'm sorry, the Americans, but you know, like, so you've got, like, the idea is a British agent who, for unknown reasons, he retires from the secret organization, and he's about to leave and go somewhere. He's drugged, and he's brought to this prison, and it's a very strange prison. It's an island. It's a village. Everyone's given numbers. including the prison guards. Nobody knows who the prisoners are, who the prison guards are. And on the surface, everything's beautiful. Everything's taken care of. Everything you want is there. They'll look after you from birth right through to old age and death. And yet, of course, it's uncanny in the Freudian sense. It's a horrible place. And the British agent is given the number 6, so he is number 6. And constantly he's trying to find out who is number 1. And every week there's a new number 2. And number 2 is always trying to break number 6, always trying to get him to tell, why did you leave the organisation? What secrets have you got? What's going on? And number 6 doesn't know who this is, doesn't know if the prison's run by the government, if it's run by a foreign body, knows nothing. And every week it's about the fight between the number 2 trying to break number 6 and number 6 trying to get free from the prison. Does that make sense? Yeah. And the point is, who is number 1? Every week, who is number 1? And the program tells you the answer. Does anybody know the answer? Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you know the answer because you read my blog or something? Yeah. There's this, in the introduction to every show, it goes like this. Number 6 says, where am I? Number 2, in the village. What do you want? We want information. Whose side are you on? That would be telling. We want information. You won't get it. By hook or by crook, we will. Who are you? The new number 2. Who is number 1? You're number 6. Or does it say, who is number 1? You are number 6. What you find out is that actually number 6 is number 1. That number 6 is being oppressed by a system that he's created. That this system is of his creation, and then now is oppressing him and destroying him. Now, it's done very surreally. But that's kind of the idea. And, of course, it's a great example of contemporary society. That we have created a system and a set of systems that oppress us. We are our own oppressors. We have created a structure that now holds us captive. And in conversion, there is a sense of a rupturing of this, where suddenly we are freed momentarily to dream new possibilities, to dream new ideas. And this is where we get into religionless Christianity. If we define the word religion... Well, that's good. If we define the word religion as any system that provides a matrix of meaning to ground your existence, right? So it's if you kind of believe in destiny, Hitler talked about destiny, that's a religious thing. You know, destiny demands that we murder these people, was kind of Hitler's thing. Destiny requires that we get rid of the Jews. Stalin talked about historical necessity. I am doing what I am doing because of historical necessity. I am just a vessel of history. That's kind of a religious idea. Someone who says, I am doing what I am doing because God is telling me to do it. That's kind of like a religious idea. So if we define religion as a kind of external kind of series of thoughts, an external idea that tells you how to act and interact in the world. Call that as religion. Then, religionless Christianity is a Christianity in which God, whatever it is, the system that defines who we are and tells us what to do, is ruptured, is broken, is destroyed, and brought down to earth. And my claim, tentative claim here, is that in a properly understood Christology, we see Christ instigating a religionless Christianity. In other words, where God dies on the cross, the God of the above. Now, that doesn't mean that God stops existing, some creator of the universe stops existing. What it means is this, is in the resurrection, God is resurrected amidst the community of believers, where people are gathered together in his name, where people give bread to the hungry, give water to the thirsty. God dies as this idea up there that stops us taking responsibility. My God, why have you forsaken me? Everything is stripped. Everything's stripped away. We feel that abandonment. We feel that loss. And as we participate in the resurrection and the new life of Christ, we participate in the birth of God in our midst, among us. So that the only way in Christianity of really encountering God and being faithful to God is in serving one another, in caring for one another. The weakness of God, not a God of strength and of might out there, a meta-narrative, but a God of weakness who is among us, incarnation, around us. And as I say, this does not mean that you have to stop believing that God as a creator exists out there. But what if you take the Christian story seriously? I want to argue that that becomes irrelevant, absolutely irrelevant. That's a philosophy question. Does God exist is a philosophy question. You ask that in philosophy class. For Christians, it's the experience of the divine abandonment, of the divine, the contraction where everything that defines who you are is stripped, and then the rebirth of meaning and God among us in our interactions. In other words, you cannot anymore say, God made me do it. You have to take responsibility for what you do in fear and trembling. You act out of love, but never knowing, oh, this is definitely what I have to do. If you get it wrong, you may have blood on your hands. We act as human beings, fractured, broken, and beautiful, but fractured. I'm kind of wondering how you're getting on with this. I don't know if I agree with me, you know. But you have to say something. And you always demand new stuff. You know, I can't come back. I've been doing this for years, you know. I've used all, you know, this is a new talk. I've got to do something. But I am kind of convincing myself, you know. That's why I do this, to convince myself. You know, and for me, this is bringing us, I'll kind of finish with this stuff. This is bringing us back to concrete Christianity. Concrete Christianity and away from abstract Christianity. Now, I mean this in the philosophical sense. We think that the concrete is what you see and hear. So this is concrete that Pete Rollins is speaking to you guys right now. And the abstract is the opaque background that got me here. The fact that there are planes and that there's a festival, there's a guy, the festival has to have people speaking, you know, I've studied theology, whatever, that got me to the point that I do this, right? So that's the abstract and this is the concrete. Well, for Hegel, it's the other way around. This is the abstract, what you see and what all of that. What's concrete are all the factors that brought me here. That's the concrete. That's the real thing. Or take politics. It says, you know, people say, you can't, there's no point doing theory. People are dying, people are starving to death. That's the concrete. But Hegel would say, no, that's the abstract. The concrete is the reasons why people are starving. And if you just try to feed the poor and you don't ask why the poor exist, you don't ask what structures are there that stop, that keep and perpetuate extreme poverty, then you'll never get anywhere. Because it's that's concrete. And it's the abstract is what you see and hear. And when you apply this to Christianity, take something like the virgin birth. We think that it's the concrete question is, was Jesus born of a virgin, as a scientific, empirical question. And the abstract is what that means to that culture, what it would have meant to the first century Jewish person who hears that claim. But Hegel would say, no, it's the other way around. The abstract question is, was Jesus really born of a virgin? And the concrete issue is, what does that mean? What is the background that provides intelligibility to that question? In other words, in first century Jerusalem, or no, first century, Caesar Augustus claimed to be born of a virgin. And that was a claim that you made to say that you had divine right. So what would have been heard when they said Jesus was born of a virgin? This person has a kingdom. But this kingdom is in a manger, not in a mansion. that this kingdom is not for the powerful, but for the powerless. That this kingdom is not for the insiders, it's for the outsiders. That's what they would have heard. Now, the question of whether it literally happened, that's an interesting question, but that's an abstract question. What's the concrete question? The concrete question is, it's about justice. It's about the incoming of a kingdom that is about liberation, about bringing in those here on the outside, about identifying with those on the outside. By the way, Paul in 1 Corinthians calls us the shit of the earth, right? Christians are the shit of the earth. Why does he say that? Because we're the excrement, the outside. We're the ones who are divested of all identity. We're the ones who have been torn from. We're in the world, but we're not of it. Suddenly the world does not have the same power over us. Hence, we're this refuge of the world. So you take the Lord's Supper. You know, the abstract question is whether this is literally the body and blood of Christ, or what do those words mean? That's the abstract. The concrete is that this is about, brilliant, that this is about participating in the divine dereliction, about divesting ourselves of meaning, about identifying with Christ on the cross and the resurrection. I'll finish with this. You know, this has radical consequences for the church. Instead of the church being a place where you bring your identity, can you imagine a church which has a suspended space, where when you enter the space, you give your identity away at the door, where there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, that it's a suspended space. You do it symbolically because you can't really forget about your identities. But symbolically, when you enter the liturgical hour, you forget if you're conservative or liberal. You put that to one side. Atheist or theist, you put that to one side. You participate in the kenosis of God. And then you enter that space in the identity with the identity of Christ. And we meet each other eye to eye beyond these political and religious identities. And as we encounter each other eye to eye, without these identities dragging us down with their operative power, we encounter each other in love, and we have a moment, a fragment of the kingdom of God. And then when we leave that place, we put our identities on again, but they don't quite fit the same. They don't define us totally. Because we have to have jobs. We have to have value systems. But the point is, these value systems now can be questioned and can be critiqued and can be changed. Okay. So perhaps then, instead of thinking of revelation as that which gives us meaning, perhaps revelation is that which bedazzles us, confuses us, and transforms us by taking away meaning. That the first act of Christianity is not giving us something, it's subtracting something from us, taking something away from us, where something becomes nothing. We become the nothing, the no identity. That's what Jesus said. He said, you must hate your mother and father. If you don't hate your mother and father, you can't follow me. What does Jesus mean? But is that not a sense of saying, until you absolutely tear yourself out of the environment and the context that defines you, until you experience yourself as more than that, as transcending that, as able to speak into and change that, you can't follow me, until you experience that break. And that's why adolescents, you know, need to hear their parents. The worst thing an adolescent can have is a nice parent, you know. What do they rebel against? Against them? That break to do something. Okay, there you go. Those are some thoughts. Have anybody got any questions? We've got 10 minutes for questions. There's a mic here. Do you want to pass it out or in, or you can shout? Can they shout? If you don't ask a question, I'll do an interpretive dance. You know? So maybe that's you want that.
Thank you. That was great. I I heard in it very much echoes of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, religionless Christianity, and what you said about living as if, well, in his words, not your words, but living as if God was not. Can you say a bit more about how he has influenced you?
By Bonhoeffer?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, Bonhoeffer's central to some of my thinking on this. Bonhoeffer talked about religionless Christianity, where he said, to live as if there is no God is one's way of living before God and with God. Now, Bonhoeffer never got a chance to develop this thinking, so you just have to take the little bits that he gave us in Letters and Papers from Prison and try to kind of extrapolate where he might have been going. And this is an attempt to kind of talk about where I think Bonhoeffer was going with that stuff. Whenever he says, to live as if there is no God is the way to live before God. Now I'm thinking about Christ, who feels the forsakenness. My God, why have you forsaken me? The total ripping of the sacred canopy as being part of what it means to be God, where God doubts God. As I said, every other religion has a place for doubt. Christianity is the only religion that places doubt into the very economy of God. Every religion has a place where you can attack the religion, but Christianity, the attack of God, is the way of being faithful to God, the sense of divine abandonment. This is from the late Bonhoeffer, Letters and Papers from Prison. Some people think that's just a progression from his earlier stuff. I think he was kind of going in a new direction. Very radical. Do you have a couple more thoughts? Oh, yep.
How do these thoughts affect how the church might think about prayer and the whole attitude the church might take toward prayer? What is praying?
What is praying? Oh, that's a good one. Praying. Wow. Yeah. The one thing I'm always interested in is finding the common denominator. There's those who believe prayer can interact and create change, and there's those who don't. There you go. There you go. That's pretty much covers them. There are people who like chocolate and people who don't. And interestingly, it's never simple. There's lots of people, I'm not sure if I believe in interventionist prayer, but I have seen some crazy things happen, including my own conversion. Had a very strange experience that involved interventionist prayer. So quite often people who don't believe it will go, well, actually, but I've seen things that I can't explain. And people who do believe in interventionary prayer go, I know, but I've never seen anything work like. So it's never simple, let's be honest. And there's that family, the parents who prayed for their kid in America because they were having an epileptic fit or something. They didn't call an ambulance. The child died, and now they're in prison. It's interesting because what they did is they just simply did what their church kind of said. You pray, you have faith, you do it, and they did the whole thing, and it didn't work. Most people, I was in this church, my friends, he's a great guy. This guy, he's a doctor, and he did a talk on healing in a charismatic church about how God heals and healing of prayer. I was sitting beside someone, it's a lie, it's not true, and the guy fell after the service and broke or really badly sprained his wrist. So I went up to the guy, and I said, can you come down and pray for this person? So he came down. I said, he's really broken his wrist. So the doctor who'd just spoken in prayer feels that, and I'm full of faith. I mean, I did stuff like, I would go down to City Hall and find people who were sick to pray for them. I remember going to this guy, and he couldn't see through one eye, and he was a goth guy. I said, bring all your mates down to the front of City Hall, and I'll heal him. In front of so there's about 30 of his mates all drinking and having a laugh, and there's me, full of the spirit. So the point being, this guy in the church prayed, said, God heal him, right, call the ambulance. In other words, didn't pray at all, just said, God heal him, call the ambulance. So he believed in interventionary prayer, but didn't really. So it's always more complicated than anything. People who say they believe don't, people who don't believe do. But the common denominator is that prayer seems to do something with us and for us. And so, again, in this suspended space, we can all agree, I think, that this spiritual practice is one that's been done since the beginning of the church. Why? Because regardless of whether it does anything out there, it seems to transform the people who are praying. Because, very quickly, The point in church is not to convince us of things. We already know. I go to a church and someone spends 45 minutes telling me that I should be nicer to the poor and nicer to my mummy and all of that. I know that. The point is I don't do it. This is the Marxist fetish, right? You tell me, I know that having cool clothes doesn't make you a nicer person, and having a bigger car doesn't make your life more enriched, and having a bigger house won't make you happy. I know that. The point is, as soon as I walk away from the conversation, I act as if having nice clothes will make me cooler, and I act as if having a better car will make me happy. In other words, you don't have to convince me, I already know it. And so the point is, prayer is an ancient form of not convincing the head of things, but of transforming our social existence. So prayer changes us. It transforms us. I don't know. There are some thoughts. Have we got time for one more? Oh, no.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have to close now for the next
okay,
one.
Thank you
very
much. Just get your tracts.